Okay, thank you. So I guess as the sole speaker after coffee, I'm really the warm-up act before today's discussion. So the title has changed slightly from the one that I submitted initially for the conference. I'm now talking about magnetic field intensification and small-scale dynamo action in compressible convection. The story of these calculations is far from complete, as you shall see, but there are sort of many issues that I think are worth highlighting. So I think it's a valuable exercise, I think. So some of this is in collaboration with various people, notably Steve Houghton, now at Leeds, and these are sort of familiar faces from Cambridge, Nigel Weiss and Mike Proctor. Okay, so, I mean, the motivation for this sort of study is obviously, you know, it's observational. So if we look at the surface of the sun, so what I've got here is a G-band image of a quiet region of the solar photosphere. I've taken this image, it's actually a screen grab from one of the movies from the Hinode website. And if you haven't looked at these movies, I do recommend that you do so. I mean, there's some really remarkable stuff in there that's certainly well worth looking at. But anyway, what are we looking at? Well, essentially we've got this well-known granulation pattern. So we've got basically lots of broad warm-up flows corresponding to the bright regions, and that's surrounded by a network of cool, narrow downflows. So these are the darker regions. So were we to look at this image in a co-spatial magnetogram, what would we see? Well, we'd see basically this field of view is covered with lots of speckles and mixed polarity line of sight magnetic field. So really, pretty much this entire field of view is covered. And what we see in the G-band is where these magnetic regions are particularly intense, we can see bright points. And I think the really interesting thing about these fields is actually the field strength. I mean, people who actually measure these things find that we've got field strengths very often in excess of a kilogauss. And what that actually means in practical terms is that if you look at the magnetic energy density of these localized regions, it's actually an order of magnitude larger than estimates for the kinetic energy density of the surrounding convection. So, I mean, these are pretty strong features, and certainly the origin is far from clear. And that's hopefully one of the questions we're going to look at today. So I think it'd be fair to say that what I'm doing is an idealized model of the solar photosphere. So it's certainly not the be-all and end-all by any means. So for instance, I'm chucking out things like radiative transfer and processes to do with things like partial ionization. So what we have here is really just a model, which is a minimal model of the interaction between compressible convection and magnetic fields. So I don't want to say too much about the equations. These should be really pretty familiar to everybody here. Just highlight a few things. Got a constant gravity vector in the z direction. Got a couple of slightly mysterious terms here, q nu and q eta. All these are is just the viscous moment heating terms, which are just not written out for ease of conciseness as much as anything else. Okay, so I've said that we're doing something that's pretty idealized, and that's pretty well exemplified by the computational domain that I've considered. So what I've done is rather than do what I guess Yuri would describe the ASHMOB do and do a sort of global calculation, I'm taking a local patch of the solar photosphere and approximating it by a horizontally periodic Cartesian box with, I guess, theorist boundary conditions, perhaps, again, is the fairest way of putting it. So impermeable, stress-free, field is constrained to be vertical, so that's the magnetic field, held at fixed temperature. So really idealized setup. Okay. So one thing we could do is start from a static state, put the magnetic field in from the initial state and see what happens. I've done something slightly differently. So I've taken what is a hydrodynamic state of convection, let that establish, which reaches a statistically steady state. Density and temperature vary by about an order of magnitude across the layer, so it's quite highly stratified. Then once it's reached this statistically steady state, this hydrodynamic convection state, I introduce some kind of seed vertical magnetic field and follow the evolution as we go. Okay, so that's the basic model setup. I don't want to say too much about numerics, I guess. They're there for people who are interested in such things to read. But I think the parameters are worth emphasizing. So I've listed my parameters here and sort of photospheric estimates on the right, and agreement's not total, let's say. I think that's fair to say. So, the Rayleigh number is reasonably large. I mean, it's 300 times the onset for convective instabilities, so it's a reasonably large Rayleigh number. But again, it's 10 orders of magnitude smaller than it should be, so we have to bear that in mind when drawing these comparisons between these simulations, what we see in the photosphere. Again, Reynolds numbers, about 150. That's going to be fixed. That one I'm going to be talking about. It's, again, reasonably modest, but does enable us to make a reasonable survey of parameter space in this parameter. So this is the magnetic Reynolds number, which I'm going to vary as we go through between these are sort of approximate. I guess it's really about 30 to about 700. So those are the ranges that I've actually looked at. Prandtl number is fixed to be unity throughout, really, for simplicity. And again, if I'm varying RM at fixed Reynolds number, that's going to give me a variation in the magnetic Prandtl number as shown. So this has been something that's been discussed already today. Okay. So I'm really going to talk about two sort of separate sets of models. Now, the first I've labelled as convective intensification. So what we have is, rather than starting from a C field with no net flux across the box, I impose some initial magnetic field that is uniform and vertical. Now, with these periodic boundary conditions, what we have in that case is that the vertical flux is actually conserved through all time. It's an invariant of the model. And so these sort of calculations are characterized by the strength of this initial magnetic field. So B0 is initially constant, and it's small. So the magnetic energy here is very much smaller than the initial kinetic energy. So it's very much a weak field sort of calculation. Because it's weak, the early phases of evolution are essentially kinematic, and the very well-known phenomenon of flux expulsion. So what we have is we've got the horizontally diverging convective flows at the surface, tend to push out magnetic flux, causing it to accumulate in the downflows around the edges. I've illustrated that here. Not sure how well these contours will show at the back, but hopefully it's clear enough. I've got contours of BZ here, that's the line of sight component of the magnetic field, overlaid upon contours of constant temperature just below the upper surface of the domain. So you can see initially, so I put the field in at time t equals zero. Initially things just go into these convective downflows. After a little bit longer, the field accumulates at the vertices around the edges of some of the granules. So there is a sort of larger scale evolution going on here. Okay, so that's all kinematic. So what happens in the nonlinear regime? Well, so one effect that really is quite significant is this idea of partial evacuation. So when we actually get these features forming, what we see is a very rapid increase in the local magnetic pressure. All that tends to do is it tends to inhibit the convective motions that are responsible for the formation of these flux concentrations. So the magnetic pressure is acting against this flux concentration process. At the same time, we've got convective downflows. These features are forming in regions where there are strong convective downflows. What these will tend to do is they'll tend to drain fluid away from the upper layers of the magnetic feature. So the action of convective downflows is to remove if you like, surface plasma, if you like, from this area. So that gives us a net imbalance between the mass inflow and the mass outflow, which ultimately leads to partial evacuation, so it leads to a drop in the gas pressure in the surface layers of the feature. So that's pretty well illustrated by these pressure maps, I guess. So one thing you can do is you can actually pick a magnetic feature, look at the surface, look at the pressure distribution on the horizontal cut to the top of this magnetic feature. So there are actually three lines in these plots, but since the dotted line is actually invisible at the back, I've taken that off the legend here. So I want you to focus on these dashed lines, which correspond to the gas pressure, and these solid lines, which correspond to the magnetic pressure. So we can see, so these are three snapshots in time. This is quite early, this is middle time, this is late. What we can see as this feature forms, the magnetic pressure grows, and there's an immediate reduction in the gas pressure. At later times, you get this really strong peak in the magnetic pressure, but a corresponding strong decrease in the local gas pressure. So there is substantial evacuation, or a substantial drop in gas pressure, within the interior of these magnetic features near the surface of the domain. And it's worth noting that if we didn't have this reduction in gas pressure, this system would actually equilibrate much earlier. You know, you'd rapidly reach a situation where the total pressure was so large that it would be inhibiting any further convective intensification. So this reduction in gas pressure is crucial if we're going to explain how really strong magnetic features can form in these kind of systems. Another thing that's also worth noting, I guess, is that magnetic pressure is actually larger than the gas pressure around the edge of this feature. which does indicate that the surrounding convective motions themselves play a crucial role in the confinement of these features to localized regions. So as I've already said, this process of partial evacuation does play a crucial role in the process of field intensification. And this is something that has been explored in some illustrative models. This idea of this convective collapse scenario, which various people worked on in the late 70s, was put forward as a mechanism by which the local magnetic energy density could exceed the mean kinetic energy density of the surrounding convection. This is something that I think is well understood theoretically. And people who've done simulations of radiative MHD have found very similar effects, so it's well known numerically as well. So it's a well-established physical process. And, you know, if there is some flux there to intensify, it's certainly fair to say that this process could explain the appearance of very strong kilogauss strength magnetic fields at the solar photosphere, which is something that's very difficult to achieve, I would say, without some level of evacuation. So in that sense, it's a good thing. However, it does give you a bit of a numerical headache. So when you actually look at these things evacuating, you then start to sort of think about your numerical scheme. And what you see is basically we've got these two processes here. So we've got the alpha in speed, which goes like B over root rho. The thermal diffusion goes like kappa over rho. And both of these things become extremely large when we've got these evacuated regions forming. And what that tells us is that the timescales associated with, I guess, thermal disturbances and alphanic disturbances, thermal diffusion, alphanic disturbances become very, very small. And if you've got an explicit numerical scheme, I guess the issue that you then have is you've got to resolve these timescales. So the critical time step for stability gets proportionally smaller and smaller and smaller. And this obviously gives you significantly increased runtime. So the calculations I've shown you, that's a bit of a pain, but you can get around it. But for what I'm going to do later, it becomes more of an issue. Okay, so everything I've said so far, we've got an imposed magnetic flux across the box. So obviously the next question to ask is what happens if there's no net flux across the domain? So if we start with a vertical field that has this cosine dependence, there's zero net flux. Obviously the key parameter then is the magnetic Reynolds number. So what happens there, obviously, as we heard this morning, if Rm is too small, diffusive effects win, everything decays. If Rm is large, then inductive effects outweigh diffusion, and we can get a growing dynamo. So these are, I guess, what Fausto described earlier as quasi-kinematic dynamos. And he was one of the guys who did the earlier studies with Boussinesq convection, which I think is now reasonably well understood. But it's fair to say the compressible case is somewhat less well understood, although people like Nick have looked in the weakly superadiabatic stratified regime, and there's been some recent calculations by Verger and Schussler, which in the large eddy approximation, and they're certainly worth a look as well. So, I mean, people are beginning to start to look at these problems. So, the nonlinear problem I'm going to come to later, but first I'm going to focus initially on the kinematic regime. That's pretty easy to study. You just turn off the Lorentz feedback. So there's no Lorentz feedback upon the flow. What I've shown here is dynamo growth rate as a function of Rm. So Rm going between about 30 and about 700 at the top here. And we can see Rm critical, again, this is growth rate of zero, so critical Rm is about here. And it's about 325, so it's, you know, it's not massive, but it's still reasonably large. Again, we don't have any shear, any rotation, so you've got to work pretty hard to drive dynamo and these sort of things. And actually, it's quite interesting that you can fit a logarithmic curve to these growth rates, which has been proposed by Rogachevsky and Kliorin, related to a somewhat different model, but only in the low PM regime. These dynamos, well, Rm, so the Reynolds number is about 150, Rm being about 300 gives us a magnetic Prandtl number of over 2. So these certainly aren't low PM dynamos. So there's a slight inconsistency there, but I think it's interesting to point out. And this magnetic Prandtl number issue has been discussed already today. Some debate in the sort of mid-2000s, or 2004, 2005, as to the viability of these dynamos at low PM. From the photosphere, PM is about 10 to minus 6. But I think now people are coming to the consensus that probably these things do work. But these simulations don't really address this parameter regime. So PM is always greater than 1 in these cases. So what do these things look like? Okay, so What we have here is a log linear plot showing magnetic energy versus time. Magnetic Reynolds number about 660. And what we have here is essentially, what, 3 decades of growth over about 30 or 40 time units. So it's a pretty convincing kinematic dynamo. What does this look like? So I've plotted here the phi squared in the mid-plane. You get a nice mix of polarities. Essentially, you can see the thing just fills the box. So there's still some kind of suggestion of structure around these thermal contours. So it's a slightly complicated profile. So these are all for reasonably small boxes. So we've got a box of aspect ratio 4. And it's certainly interesting to ask the question, what happens if we increase our box size? Now, I thought it might make a small difference to both the growth rates and the critical RM. Actually, I was surprised at how large a difference it did make. So just by doubling the box size, we get quite substantial variations, not only in the growth rates for fixed RM, but also it seems to lower the critical value of RM for dynamo action. So just by increasing the box size. I've only got 3 points at the moment on this curve, so I'm not going to try fitting a line through it at this stage, but it's certainly suggestive. Okay. Probably what's going on, I think, is in the smaller box, with an artificial periodicity imposed by the geometry. And that's actually leading to more mixing of polarities than we should be seeing in the real case, which tends to lower the growth rates of the dynamo. So that's probably a sort of simple explanation of what's going on. So very briefly, I'm going to mention something about this the nonlinear case. So this is obviously a bit more of a headache. There's a reasonably high-resolution simulation. RM is about 500. And again, this left-hand plot shows magnetic energy versus time. You can look at this and convince yourself, all right, great, we're in the kinematic regime, it's growing exponentially, fine, no problem. But actually, this thing is non-linear. And really, very quickly, what happens, if you look at minimum density versus time, is you'll see a general trend for this to go down. So locally, these magnetic features that form in this dynamo are exerting a very significant dynamical effect upon the dynamo. And if you keep integrating this further, Armin gets smaller and smaller and smaller, your time step goes to zero, essentially, and the calculation grinds to a halt. So, see what these things look like. And since I'm being told I'm running out of time, so those are basically the conclusions. Non-zero net flux, certainly if you've got some flux present in the system, you can actually certainly intensify things to quite a sort of significant field strength. With no net flux, essentially most of what I've talked about is kinematic. Box size seems to make a difference. That's worth bearing in mind. And we've got this issue with the nonlinear effects becoming important. So I really want to highlight these problems. So really, to actually do these calculations with an explicit scheme is really not a good idea. You know, you reach the point where, because of these time steps that you need to take, the stability becomes so small that the calculations do become prohibitively expensive. So there's certainly calls for perhaps doing something a little bit clever with numerics. Say some kind of adaptive mesh system, some kind of perhaps artificial density floor would be a simple way of dealing with it, or perhaps some kind of semi-implicit treatment for the offending terms would simplify things. And it's also worth noting that relating these things to photosphere, we've got a slightly unrealistic gravity regime. So that also is worth bearing in mind, I think. I'll finish there. Thank you.
I mean, I think if you choose AMR, it's not going to help you, right?
Sure. Yeah, I think, I mean,
your time AM, step is, it will be nicely resolved by your time step.
Absolutely. I mean, AMR, so. I guess, would allow you to perhaps use...
You have to go number two or yeah, number three.
Sure.
The easiest one is just go for number two, just put
it
forward.
Yeah. But then I guess it's a balancing act between doing something that's reasonable in terms of... Yeah.
You showed it was growing exponentially even when nonlinear effects were important, but if you did the purely kinematic problem, so you really did the kinematic problem with that velocity field, it would presumably grow exponentially with a different growth rate.
I guess it might. I mean, I've not checked the exact change, but I think it's pretty close, actually. I mean, it really is very local. I mean, you know, it's perhaps a couple of percent, but it's really pretty small.
But that may change with the
with
the different parameters.
Sure.
Paul, this magnetic pressure exceeding gas pressure locally. Are there any simple relations, how much it exists, how it depends on parameters? It can be an important and interesting feature, right?
Yeah, sure.
So is there any simple dependencies on parameters there? Could you notice anything of that sort?
Not clear, but I mean, certainly it becomes more pronounced at larger values of Rn. But it's sort of hard to sort of get a scaling on it. It's most dramatic during the initial phase of amplification, and then kind of sort of evens out a little bit. But still, I mean, you do find an excess of magnetic pressure. But it's sort of difficult to sort of quantify, I would say.
That's it. Well, thank you very much again. Well, the next.